Woodbury Reports with your host, Lon Woodbury, talking with leading professionals about how parents and others can help their struggling teens, preteens, and young adults. Now here's your host, Lon Woodbury.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. We're going to talk about technology today. And the topic is winning the technology arms race. And the person, the expert or professional that's going to talk about it is Aaron McGinley. Aaron, good morning.
Hi.
Good morning for me, at least. Afternoon for you. Aaron's the program chairman of Black Mountain Academy. And it's a school for kids on the autism spectrum, level one, what used to be called Asperger's. And so I want to start off, what do you mean arms race? What's going on? Who's racing against who in the technology thing?
Well, I would be willing to bet that if you turned on the news on any given night this week, no matter what the news channel is, after you got past kind of the political cloud of this year, you would eventually see a story about technology. It may be a story about technology and students. It may be about technology and celebrities or politicians. But you will see something happened that related to the news, email, tweets, or Facebook. And it's the tip of the iceberg. So what I mean, Lon, is that our relationship with technology is changing. And for those of us, myself included, who grew up without cell phones, who weren't plugged in growing up, the world has changed tremendously in 30 years. But for teenagers and children, they grew up on technology. And so they are more aware in some instances of new apps coming out every day, new technologies coming out every day, and sometimes a cultural shift in how technology is used. A good example being, when I first got a Facebook account, it was really on a dozen college campuses and really hard to get. And it kind of has shifted now to something where students that I've worked with when I was doing therapy in the public schools, they won't put a lot of sensitive information on Facebook because they know mom, dad, grandma, and grandpa are watching.
Oh, yeah.
So to answer your question, what technology is available to our students is changing.
It's changing drastically. And what you're talking, I was thinking, I forget the name of the author that made it popular, McGinnis or something like that. The medium is the message. Well, the medium is drastically changing. You know, as Facebook has changed and it's changing this year, I'm hearing some complaints that they gotten pulled into the political campaign, but it's changing as to what they can do. And it's awfully hard for parents to keep on top of it.
Yeah, just take a look at Facebook. A great example is Facebook now has encrypted messaging, which means that your child could potentially send scary information, inappropriate pictures to somebody else end to end, and it would be very difficult if the child is in an unsafe situation to kind of break into the middle of that message in a way that it wasn't difficult a year ago. And the same's the case for nearly any app, is that parents that sometimes feel like using parental control software to support, keeping an eye on their child if their child's a little bit young but thinks they're a little bit old, that there's now a plethora of ways to, there's proxy servers and ways for students that are not aware of the consequences of their actions to kind of beat the system, if you will, that weren't there a year or two ago. And so in a lot of ways, that's what I'm speaking about when I talk about an arms race, is that parents are trying to keep up with the way that technology is changing parenting and changing childhood. But it's not an easy thing to do. And sometimes they need some support in that process.
Oh, absolutely. It sounds like it's sort of a technology evolution versus parents. Is the race with the parents always one step behind?
Even when you're trying, what I think of is, I have 18 years of experience in this field. I make it my business to keep up with technology trends, and it's a pretty regular occurrence that there's something new on the scene. I have Google alerts sometimes set up on my email, that I will get daily about changes to things that can impact our students. You know, for instance, I work with students on the spectrum. Some of them struggle with social boundaries. They might not be fully aware of the ways in which people might manipulate them. You know, 1 out of 5 minors in general without special needs who is online is approached in some way with sexual overtones by an adult. And so there's a really scary world out there. And I work with folks that are sometimes particularly vulnerable to that. And even though I make it my business to keep up with technology changes, I still find that that's a very intentional effort. And so parents who lead very busy lives, who maybe aren't as oriented towards technology as I may be, are going to struggle even more.
Is there any patterns or a particular type of kid that is most vulnerable? Because I know there are cases of some kids will tell their parents, oh, yeah, I ran across a pornography on it. No big deal. I just pass right on. And no problem. But what are the type of kids or what are the psychological aspects of a kid that is most vulnerable to temptation or whatever you call it on the internet?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So first of all, the research is young, but I can tell you what it's shown so far is that there are certain mental health challenges, ADHD and autism being one of them, that students using it reflect a higher rate of internet use, video game use, social media use. And then there are certain other mental health challenges that can be made more complicated by the presence of the internet. A good example of this is if you have a young lady who injures herself, there's a lot of web pages now where she could actually become more aware of the ways in which to injure herself and hide it from others. But to hone in real big, one of my big concerns is that for people who struggle with impulse control, people who struggle with managing and thinking through the consequences of their actions, there's a good chance that one of the neurotransmitters that's involved is dopamine. Now, dopamine is the same neurotransmitter that's involved in cocaine use. It's involved in smoking. This is why, for instance, people with ADHD are at risk for smoking. In a way, it's self-medicating. Well, in a way, video games kind of self-medicating in that if you play a high reinforcement game, and I'm thinking of games like Grand Theft Auto or something where there's some sort of action happening all the time, you're really, what you're doing to your brain is you're kind of creating bursts of dopamine in the same way that cocaine would cause a burst of dopamine, a short-term sensation that can be destructive to your brain. And what they're finding is that it causes this ripple effect where playing too much video games, it can kind of destroy things like the motivation centers of your brain. They find this a lot with people who get involved in electronic pornography at a young age, is that it starts off as an issue that's impacting their sexual functioning and their thinking around sexual issues. But what it ends up doing is it ends up creating a lot of challenges with executive functioning and a lot of difficulties with literal dependence because it's one thing for me, you know, as an adult who didn't grow up on video games to play because I already have a fully formed frontal lobe. But if you're cooking your kid in an environment where they're playing too many video games or whatnot, they may already be at risk if they have ADHD or autism for difficulties with impulse control or executive functioning or anxiety management.
Well, let's go back to the one thing that you said a little bit earlier, and sort of the basis of all this is the dopamine. And it's sort of a way you've been talking. Dopamine encourages this kind of negative behavior, but it's sort of neutral. Dopamine is the feel good. You feel good if you success. Feel good if you win a prize, there's a lot of positive things to it, and it's very vital. It's just, this is a situation where it helps you get into negative self-harming behavior. Is that
that's a good point. If you take my kindergartner and you put her on some reading software, And it gives a little prize when you're doing well reading. I can tell you right now that her reading scores will go up, and they will go up rapidly. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to criminalize dopamine. What is the challenge is that certain types of video games, especially in certain profiles of children, can flood the brain with dopamine.
And it feels so good that they can't stay away, right?
Yeah, and parents might be implementing a completely reasonable limit. You know, American Medical Association, they may say 2 hours a day for screen time total. But in the same way that you may not know you're a cocaine addict or an alcohol addict until you tried it the first time, parents may be giving what may at first be a reasonable boundary, and very quickly, because of a student's neurological profile, they may be seeing some real difficult behaviors when the video games are not available. You know, video games are like this attraction for all sorts of kids, but you'll find that there are some kids that really get hooked into them pretty quickly. And what happens is, because of some of the disruptive behaviors, you know, in some kids it may be yelling or cursing, other kids refusing to go to school, it becomes a kind of a tenderfooted issue for parents. Is they're not quite sure how to approach it, and it becomes a big challenge very quickly.
Well, you know, one of the things that I see then you were talking about earlier about the vulnerable kids, autism, probably some ADHD, people in the autism spectrum, they have trouble with social relationships, and very often those are not satisfying because there's a difficulty in communicating. And somebody like that's feeling a little isolated, they can go into a game like Grand Theft Auto or Halo or any of those that are action-packed, and they make virtual friends, and it's very satisfying. And it's, in a sense, it's sort of self-medicating, and in my mind, it's self-medicating because they're being successful at something.
You're absolutely right there's a number of things that they're avoiding. It may be homework. It may be going to the junior high dance. It may be navigating eye contact with peers. A number of the students that we work with carry a lot of social anxiety, and it absolutely is easier to go into a game where the social rules are straightforward, where it's likely that you could connect. You know, if you're going to a small high school and you're only kid on the spectrum in the high school, are you going to find a kid on the spectrum like you? Probably not. But if you're plugged into an avatar game with 20 million users, there's a good chance that you may bump into someone. And so in a lot of ways, they're getting needs met online that are harder to meet in real life.
Yeah.
And for parents to honor the ways in which video games serve some of those needs is a first step in a conversation, in that if you just demonize video games and you don't take a breath and think through what is this doing for the kid and kind of really connect with the kid about, tell me about this game that you're playing, then you lose out on the chance to learn what the game does for the kid that the real world isn't. And mm-hmm. that gives you an opportunity to figure out, okay, what are the skills that we need to help them build so that the video games aren't so attractive? One of the things we do at Black Mountain Academy is, if we're going to suspend their video game usage, if we're going to kind of hold them back on this area that is a relief and an avoidance of anxiety, we're going to help them develop alternative replacement behaviors. We're going to build a wellness plan with them. We're going to support their development of coping skills. We're going to support their development of social skills. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And we've about run out of time, so why don't you just continue that last thought. Talk about Black Mountain Academy and a little bit of what you do, contact information and that. And so I'll give you about a minute or so, and then we have to close it up.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. Black Mountain Academy is east of Asheville, North Carolina, at www.theblackmountainacademy.com. We work with students ages 14 to 17 with level 1 autism. We help them in a community-based model and a residential model, building social and life skills, preparing for life after high school and life during high school. We use a number of clinical supports on campus and off, community partnerships, community service, to help them build the lives that we all know that they are capable of. And they just need a little bit extra support along the way.
Okay, well, that sounds very good. And contact information, phone number of the office, email, website?
Absolutely. Folks want to talk to me in general about any of the technology issues. I'm happy to respond to any emails at amcginley@theblackmountainacademy.com. And our website is the same. It's theblackmountainacademy.com. Our phone number is area code 828-357-4383. Again, that number is 828-357-4383. And again, my email address is amcginley@theblackmountainacademy.com. And we're always happy to talk with folks, whether it's about technology or about maybe providing the right type of support for kids on the spectrum, and helping them build the life that they deserve. So just give us a call or send me an email if you have questions.
Well, this is Lon Woodbury with Woodbury Report. Been talking with Aaron McGinley. He's the program chairman at Black Mountain Academy, and that's a school for high-functioning autistics, and we're talking about winning the technology arms race. Thank you very much. Very good. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Juan.